James Bigby is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Bigby to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. The Execution Watch for James Bigby begins. Tonight's program is dedicated to our mentor and good friend, Jim Skelton, who passed away last week. Rest in peace, Jim.
This is Ray Hill, and tonight is one of those nights I'm never glad to do this show, so I don't want to thank you for listening in because it's difficult for all of us. Execution is very serious business. But tonight I'm going to take a few seconds here to talk to the guys on the row. I do that from time to time. Most of the time when I do Execution Watch, I'm talking to all of the audience. But tonight I want to take just a minute to talk to guys on the row because you guys are used to death. You're friends. They come in and get them and drag them out of there, and sometimes they follow peacefully and sometimes they fight back, but they take them somewhere and they kill them. And so you're used to death. That's kind of part of the world you live in. The rest of us don't live in that kind of world. So please excuse that we have a difficult time understanding the kind of world that you live in. But we all lose people. I lost Dewey. Just last year. Dewey had been my engineer for years. And tonight on Execution Watch, there's a voice missing, and it's a baritone. And I don't know if you know as much about choirs. I know very little about it. But if you build a choir and you take the baritones out, you're missing some resonances that would otherwise be there and are sorely missed. Jim was your friend. He came up and he interviewed you in the The problem I had with him doing interviews is he tended to enjoy getting to know you and talking to you at length because he had an enormously inquisitive mind. Jim, from time to time, received criticism from people in the free world because he followed my edict. It wasn't his decision. When we report a case, we do it as straight news, just the facts. We can editorialize later, and Jim followed that. As a result, many abolitionists screamed about Jim's position on things, and he was just doing what he was told. Last week we were on the air, and Rolando Ruiz was scheduled to be executed. We did the show from 6 until 7 o'clock, and they didn't actually kill Rolando until sometime after 10. Well, Jim slipped out quietly with Rolando after the show. He didn't come to the show last week. He wasn't feeling well enough, and now both of them are gone. We're going to miss him. I've been talking to the legal team, and they're going to have trouble reconstructing the whole thing. But they're working on it, and they do it for the same reason Jim did it, because you guys deserve not to go quietly into the darkness. You guys deserve to be heard, your cases looked at, and your trials analyzed. That's what Execution Watch is about. My name is Ray Hill, and I'm going to turn to Paige. Hey, Paige. What happened in this case?
Okay. In reference to Mr. Bigby, in the early morning hours of December 24th, 1987...
Wait a minute. I got Pat on the phone. Pat, what's going on up there? Pat?
Yes?
What's happening?
The witnesses walked across about 4 or 5 minutes ago. He only had three people, and they were Michael Grasnick from the press, and that was probably Cody, the guy from the Huntsville item, and then one of the chaplains.
Chaplains and media.
Yes. By his request, Mr. Bigby has no one here. He had no witnesses. He called no one in his last hours. However, we have about 15 anti-death penalty people out here who will always protest regardless if they want anybody to witness or not. We protest the death penalty.
Yep, the whole thing.
Yes, yes, we do. We know that Mr. Bigby had given up his appeals, and we're not here to judge. We're here to protest the death penalty.
Okay, Pat, give us a call when so if you get any other information.
I expect it to go pretty fast.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'll call you back. Okay, bye-bye.
Dave Atwood.
Hey.
Hey, welcome back. You've been gone a while.
I have been gone a while, but I'm in Houston right now. And I'm at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd by St. Anne's Catholic Church. Beautiful day out here in terms of the weather, certainly. It's been a lot worse at other times. But we're here with our banners, our signs, our people. We've got, let me see, we've got about seven people here right now. And that's about typical for... that's about typical for our vigils these days. And, of course, we got a group up there in the north part of Houston, too, that are doing a vigil.
So, in Spring, Texas, yes, near Woodlands.
Yes, right, right. And that's good because, you know, traveling the city is really, really tough. And we can't expect those people to come down here or even from the other side of town too much. So, but we've got a good group here, and we're doing what we're doing. We're protesting the death penalty. If anybody stops by, we tell them why. We talk to them. And we've been out on this corner I don't know how many times over the years, many, many, many times. We move this vigil around. We've got four different locations in the downtown Houston area. So we hit different groups every time. And I've always told people, I think that these street vigils and protests do actually a lot of good because most of the people that come by now give us a thumbs up or honk their horn in a positive way. And that wasn't the case years ago. So we think things are getting better from that perspective.
Jim, you know about the farewell event for Jim Skelton tomorrow?
Yes, I do. Yeah, boy, I tell you, that's tough, losing Jim. Losing Dewey before him, just really, really hard to lose these old-timers.
Yeah, and we still lean on one another.
Yeah, that's right. But we're here today, and any guys that are listening on death row, I think they know we're out here for them, doing everything we can do.
What's your organizational website?
It's TCADP.org. TCADP.org.
Thank you, Jim.
You take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. And that was Jim Skelton out at St. Anne's Church. If you tuned in and were looking for Nuestra Palabra, it is on the air, but it's not on the air on the broadcast channel. It's on HD3, and you can find that by going to kpft.org. And you have several selections. You have broadcast, you have HD1, and we're on both of those. So then go down to HD2 and HD3, and when you get to HD3, you will find Nuestra Palabra, who are just in the studio on the other side of a couple of panes of glass, bringing good broadcasting for the Spanish-speaking community, although they do very little of it in Spanish. Now I'm going to go back to Paige, and we'll continue what happened in this story.
All right. And again, we are December 23rd, 1987. And James Bigby, who is our gentleman this evening, had a get together with a friend of his, Michael Treichel. Michael Treichel was babysitting his son, Jason. And Jason was about 4 months old. In any event, Michael Treichel's wife came home early morning hours of December 24th, 1987, and found Michael Treichel's body on the kitchen floor in their trailer home. She called 911, not realizing that he was deceased. And then as she was talking to 911, she remembered that her husband was taking care of the baby. And she went to look for the baby and found the baby face down in a sink full of water. It turns out that Michael Trakel had been shot by a .357 in his head, and that the baby had died as a result of drowning. On December 26th, 2 days later, the Fort Worth police came to negotiate a standoff with police at a motel in Tarrant County. Inside the motel was James Bigby, and he said to the detective, "I know that I am guilty, and so do you." And he surrendered without incident. And the next morning, he gave a confession. A couple of years go by, and in a capital case, that's not unusual that a couple of years could go by between the facts and the trial. And the trial is held in 1991. During a recess in the trial, during the guilt and innocence phase, Mr. Bigby found a gun on the unoccupied bench of the judge, Judge Leonard. Took it, and in an apparent attempt to escape, ran into the judge's office and pointed the gun at the judge's head, stating, "Let's go." He was subdued both by the judge, a bailiff, and another officer. Bigby's attorneys asked the judge for a mistrial. This was ultimately denied, and whether or not the judge was to recuse himself was discussed, and there was a hearing on that with the administrative judge of the region. It was determined during the hearing that the judge could be fair and impartial, and the trial continued.
Well, the jury did not witness the gun thing.
No, absolutely not. This was all out of the presence of the jury, and so they did not know about it. However, during the guilt-innocence phase, during the state's rebuttal, the judge permitted the jury to hear about the facts of this assault. And that went to the issue of premeditation and future dangerousness.
Sure, and of course the jury's in there contemplating premeditation and future dangerousness, and the judge said, "Oh, by the way."
Yeah, oh, by the way.
Yeah, okay. Okay, gotcha. Gotcha. Where did this happen? Tarrant County?
Tarrant County, yes.
Yeah, Jim would say at this point, this is another one of them Fort Worth cases. strange things happen in Tarrant County. You won't. I'm sitting here looking at
you. Looking at me.
At Larry and Larry. Okay. Larry, you remember those words from Jim?
I remember those words from Jim. And the as you know, Ray, we've discussed already. We're going to really miss Jim because not only was he a powerful voice on this broadcast, but we actually spoke some of his words because Jim would prepare all the materials.
Yeah.
And give them to us, and he would prepare summaries actually. Because he'd read everything.
He was not closeted about his opinion of Tarrant County.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. But he would give us the salient facts. I mean, and then this case was a pretty tragic case, Jim. Because Bigby actually went over to Trakel's house with two steaks for Trakel to cook. Okay? And that's how they got together.
I mean, they went to eat.
And so while Trakel's cooking the steaks, Bigby walks up behind him and shoots him in the back of the head. And then he goes and kills the baby.
That'll mess up your steak.
And then he goes and kills the baby. And then he goes and kills two other people. So
yes.
he's got capital. Now, but the fact is, though, and I know Bigby had a hard life. Okay? Bigby had a real difficult upbringing. His mother allegedly drank while she was pregnant with him and breastfed until he was 7 years old. His mother also gave away several siblings to other family members, and he feared abandonment from his mother, just as he feared that just his father had abandoned him. His mother and other family members suffered mental health issues. And mental health is a real big issue in this case, Ray. And he'd previously been hospitalized on multiple occasions for schizoaffective disorders and for depression. He also had electroshock therapy during one of his stays there. And he's had been arrested several times for various robberies and sexual offenses, dropped out of school when in the ninth grade, and went to work for Frito-Lay as an auto mechanic. And his reasoning in terms of committing the killing, he was paranoid.
Yeah.
And he just he filed a workers' comp claim against Frito-Lay. And Frito-Lay, in processing his claim, they did some things he thought that other people were trying to thwart his ability to collect from Frito-Lay. So, for instance, that there was an investigator who followed him. And so what he did was he sees the investigator following him, apparently investigating the claim. He rams his car into the investigator.
Okay.
And he also thinks that other people, including his father, other people are trying to thwart his claim, including Trakel. So he has this thought in his mind that Trakel, for some reason, is keeping me from collecting money from Frito-Lay. So that might have been part of his reasoning. You had some comments on that?
And the three adults who were killed by Mr. Bigby in the space of about 7 hours were related to Bigby only. They were not related to Frito-Lay. And it appears that his psychiatric problems developed subsequent, and this is from my reading of the cases, it appears that his psychiatric problems developed subsequent to his entry at Frito-Lay, which caused the workers' comp claim. I cannot tell how long, but his first psychiatric hospitalization occurred in 1986, and the workers' comp claim was filed in 1985-86 as well. He was in a psychiatric hospital on three separate occasions between 1986, and 1987.
Well, I mean, there wasn't any indication the truck fell on his head.
No, sir, there wasn't, and not in the cases.
In the general business of executions, and y'all jump in. Jack's here too. Y'all jump in if you want to. Mike's here. Just because you're paranoid schizophrenic or you have one of these diagnoses with these Montezuma names on it, that doesn't give you an exemption from being executed. That doesn't even play. Now, if you're mentally incapacitated because of mental retardation or some other learning severe disability and they don't think that you are functional, that's a get out. But crazy is not a get out.
No.
Any more than being drunk and stoned and stupid.
Insanity was raised as an affirmative defense in his trial on the merits.
But it didn't work.
But the jury rejected it. And
but the judge allowed it, but it just didn't work.
Of course.
Okay.
And it was discussed in both the... it was discussed heavily in the first federal writ. But the problem about all that is that his pattern of behavior did not show his group. When you group all the actions together, his pattern of behavior was not such that a jury would think he had lost the normal use of his mental and physical faculties, and he was unable of understanding right and wrong. The fact that he looked at the detective at the motel in Fort Worth
and said, "You know I did it, and
you
know
I did it, and I'm wrong, take me in." I mean, that statement, as well as the... Actually, there were two confessions, and they were consistent. Yeah. It just... That does...
There was literally nothing... Jack didn't need literally nothing for a defense lawyer to do.
Not really. I mean, it's...
you know, the only way to win an insanity defense is, you know, for example, do you know what you did is wrong? Potato. That might get you off. But if, you know, anything more than potato, yeah, the insanity defense is not going to work. And, you know, under the circumstances, I mean, I'm looking at his appeals, and he has the usual appeals of, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel, which 99 times out of 10 is not, you know, I mean, you have these attorneys who day and night they work on capital cases, they slave over these things with, you know,
but they know this one is not going to work, but they do it anyway.
Do it
out of boredom, out of having nothing else to do?
No, out of the desperate hope that the law
will catch traction.
The law will change, or something will catch on, or a juror will bite on it.
Even if they don't get it in a trial, it might be valuable to some appellate lawyer down the line.
Or habeas lawyer.
It's literally a, you know, throwing feces on a Teflon wall and hoping something sticks. It's not gonna. I mean, there may be a couple of particles that stick, but that's just not enough to sink your teeth in.
Well, the only person that's going, only people that are going to mourn Mr. Bigby, apparently his fellows on the row. You ever thought about that? The only friends he's got in the world are the people that he left earlier today to go get executed. Because there's no family there, there's no friends there, there's a couple of newspaper reporters, and you know about newspaper reporters, I love them to death, but they just want to use up the ink.
And he has been in custody.
This is the first time he has had a date.
This is his first.
And he's been there for over
25
years.
Yes, sir. Well, a lot of that can be attributed to the fact that his trial happened in 1991.
Yeah.
Penry 1 happened in 1989.
Tell us who Penry 1 was.
Okay.
Now, and compare and contrast Penry 1 with Penry. We got a couple of Penrys here.
Oh, boy. Okay. Penry 1 talks about the fact that you cannot execute someone who does not have the IQ, the intelligence quotient, to appreciate the results of their actions.
And that can be true at the time you did it, and also be true at the time you're getting executed. Two-sided sword. It doesn't work if you are not, don't have the capacity it happened, and it doesn't work if you don't have the mental capacity that you know they are killing you and why.
Yeah, when you deal with competency, it has to do with the executions part. now, Penry 2 came down in 2001, so from 1989 to 2001. And Penry 2 was after the retrial on Penry 1.
Okay.
Penry 2 came down, and Penry 2 talked about how you deal with instructions and special issues in a capital trial and whether or not instructions can give directions to the potential jurors that would conflict with the directions inherent in the special issues. And in fact, the reason why this case with Mr. Bigby had a second writ of habeas corpus decided by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals had to do with the fact that it violated Penry 2.
Larry?
Jim, you mentioned, Ray, sorry.
The second time you've done that.
Got Jim on the brain.
The ghost is in the room and deserves to be. There's plenty of room for Jim's ghost in this room.
But you mentioned his family, and this
he's all alone.
Reminded me, but his father testified.
His father testified, but his father didn't show up for the execution, so he's all alone.
And his lawyers fully litigated, as they should, the issue of sanity at trial. Because that whole issue is, did he know what he was doing was wrong? And they had a classic battle of the experts. Some saying he didn't know the difference between right and wrong. Others saying that he did. Even his father says, yes, he knew the difference between right and wrong. the expert battle notwithstanding, we don't just leave it to the experts, because the jury has to decide whether they believe he's sane or not at the time. And the jury hears not just the expert testimony, which was conflicted, but also the testimony of the occurrence. That is, flight can be used as evidence of
guilt. Yeah, well, that judge wasn't up there waving that gun around, and Bigby was able to figure out it was back there.
But even the flight after the first killing, okay, because he ran away, there was a manhunt for him, they catch him at the motel. And so even the issue of his saying, you know I'm guilty, as well as I know I'm guilty. But I know I'm guilty, does that mean that I understand that my actions are wrong? So the lawyers actually went that far to say, look, you know, just because he says I'm guilty doesn't necessarily mean that I understand that my actions are wrong. Now, that's the argument that has to be made, and the jury has to decide that, is because the jury, because the issue is not, does he think he's guilty? The issue is, does he understand that his actions, that he suffers from a mental illness, and as a result of that mental illness, he is unable to determine whether his actions are wrong.
Mike, I'm going to bring you in right now. If this happened in Channelview, Texas, and you were appointed in this case, what the hell would you have done?
Well, first of all, we have a unique situation where, is this his fault or society's fault?
Now, this is the third or fourth time we've come here to do this show, and you bring this issue up. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, a child is born to a mother with drug problems. Nowadays,
as a matter of fact, he nursed her long enough to be her drinking buddy.
They would take him away from the mother for his own protection, but society did not take him away from his mother. The mother breastfed him till he was 7. Society would take him away from his mother, but they didn't. So you have a young man that society failed. As he grows up, he is institutionalized, he is diagnosed, everybody makes money, doctors make money, but nobody helps him. He goes to electroshock therapy.
And that's heavy stuff.
For a young man.
I know people who were electroshocked to be cured from being gay, and that didn't work.
Well, at what point in time did these doctors have the ability 3 different times to do something about him and keep society safe? We say we have to execute somebody to save society. It seems like he went through the system with all of these red flags on him and all these people living in big houses, making big money, thinking they're better than everybody else. They're too busy to help this man. The fact remains is he needed help. The fact remains that nobody helped him. And when he did what he did, it's such a horrible fact scenario that everybody will think he's horrible, but society is horrible for not helping him. The issue that came up also is that he seems to have found religion at the last minute. And that becomes an issue too, because if we have any reason for putting people in prison, the old concept of penitentiary is penance, which is you lock a person down, let him sit alone and think about everything and change his ways. If he sat in prison and changed his ways and found God, should he not be judged on execution at the time he's executed, his mental frame of mind at the time of execution or at the time he committed the crime? I think that you can punish a man with jail time for what he did, but to execute a man who has already found peace to himself and has changed his ways, we now become murderers. And that's what's going on here. One more factor I'd like to mention. I do not understand these lawyers. What gets me is that as late as September 2016, his lawyers are filing papers with the court saying he's uncooperative, he's uncommunication, he's unable to rationally communicate his state of mind and mental ability. That's a serious allegation. In September 2016, less than a month later, they say he's okay. His own lawyers, after saying they can't communicate with him because he's uncooperative, 30 days later they drop and say, oh, he's okay.
Well,
how can he be okay in 30 days?
Well, it wasn't 30 days. What did happen is that the judge notified the lawyers that he was planning on setting an execution date. And they said that they needed time to talk to him in order to make certain that he actually did understand what was going on and that he had been uncooperative because he has consistently refused he has consistently refused medication ever since his arrest in 1987. Okay?
Okay. So what Paige is telling me, and I don't really know anything about this stuff, but he is removed enough from reality that he needs medication to bring him back. One of those situations, remember, we had a case here that was delayed for a long time because the guy would not take the medications. And without the medication, he wasn't sane enough to kill. Do you remember that case? I don't think it was of Texas, but we followed it because we are who we are. But he's stewing in a cell by himself, dancing with whatever demons that he carried in there with him, and in his case, there may have been a bunch of those, without medication. So this man had been severely punished before they killed him. But in any case, I mean, just first rattle out of the box, you have a trial, you get sentenced to death, and then 25 years they kill you?
By that time he found religion. We do not know if he's the same man at the time that he was executed.
They're never the same people. We don't ever kill the same person that did the crime.
Well, and Rolando Ruiz, our defender from last week's lawyers, argued in one of their appeals to the United States Supreme Court that it was cruel and unusual and violative of the Eighth Amendment.
Rolando was out there with like 40 relatives.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Rolando had a posse around him when they killed him.
The next thing I think is interesting is future dangerousness. You know, you read these facts, you read about what he did, and you think about how dangerous this man is. He took a gun and pointed to the judge, but he didn't shoot the judge.
Would you be willing to have him parole into your house?
That's not the question. The question is life in the penitentiary.
Of course, Jim would say, well, the judge probably deserves shooting. He never met one that didn't, but...
Yeah, but the fact
is... He very well might
if
have
he's so dangerous...
Like if he's not so dangerous, why don't we parole him into your house?
Well,
at this point of time,
because we can't parole.
Yeah, right. Can't parole.
Oh no, I understand.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's serious business. The man's being put to death all alone. He's by himself. He doesn't have any witnesses that are from his family. He doesn't have any witnesses except some chaplain somewhere who's probably praying the wrong flavor of prayer for him, and two newspaper reporters. And they're nice guys. I know Grasick is a nice guy, but he's looking for some way to expend some ink.
But isn't that what he wanted?
It's his choice.
Let me rephrase myself. One of the problems the boy had was since his mother gave away all of his siblings, he has fear of abandonment.
Yep.
And that's a big issue that we're understanding now with children, the fear of abandonment. He has been abandoned at his death. His fear has come true.
Well,
everything that he feared is now. I think this is one of the most horrible fact situations we have seen. But still, we're a Christian society. We're supposed to have mercy. If we don't have mercy, we're not Christians.
I want to thank Will on the row for writing me. Thank you, Will. I appreciate getting your letter. And I want to thank Garland for writing me. Keep all of that in mind. I'll answer you via JPay. It's easier for me to do that. Jim probably would have said that judge up there, that packing judge.
And
that would have struck down. Jim spent some time as a judge. I don't think he had a piece behind his bench.
You never know. You know? Judges are concerned. The biggest concern I have with the judge, though, which is, and Jim and I have talked a lot of times about prosecutorial discretion, which they have a wide degree of discretion in their decision making. This case presented a vast amount of judicial discretion, in my
opinion.
Because if a person finds the judge's weapon at the bench and then goes to the judge's chambers down the hall in an apparent attempt to
escape. I've been to the courtroom. I've been from the courtroom to I know this is back, what, 1991. I was in Tarrant County Jail to be an expert witness on a gay panic homicide case. And I just showed up, and the prosecutor said he's going to take the capital off the table. And so I was awarded, without saying a word, what I went up there to do. And so I thanked the criminal defense lawyers for the invitation and the plane ride up and cheap hotel room, and I went on about my business. So I have been from where the courtroom is down the back hall to the judge's office in that courthouse. And it's not a short distance.
But the judge had
the pistol at the bench because of his concern for his own safety.
Where was the bench?
And when the Bigby goes to the chambers and said, "Let's go, judge," the judge defends him off himself.
Yeah.
Judge comes over his desk. Now, whether he tried
to
shoot him
or not, wakes up or stops doing whatever he's doing with his hand.
But actually, what actually happened was that in the courtroom, the defendant was sitting alone, and the bailiff was there in the courtroom.
Okay.
And the defendant got up, and the bailiff was doing bailiff duties, whatever.
Yeah, right.
And the defendant got up and went over toward the bench, and somewhere toward on or nearby the bench
was
the judge's gun. He grabs it, turns it on the bailiff. The bailiff, you know, basically hits the deck behind
this duck and cover, like
hits the deck
the Russians
behind
are coming
behind the desk, and draws his own weapon, attempts to stop Bigby. Bigby goes up, tries to threaten him. The bailiff, you know, basically just runs like hell. And then Bigby goes down the hallway into the judge's chambers. The judge is sitting alone in his chambers, and he comes up to the judge, and the judge is reading or something and doesn't even notice him coming up, the defendant coming upon him. And the judge looks up, stands up, hits his arm with the gun,
okay,
and pins him against the wall and screams at the top of his lungs. And a different bailiff, his grand jury bailiff, comes running into chambers. And at that point, he's finally subdued.
Okay.
But the concern I have in terms of discretion at this point, Ray,
is the judge went on trying this case.
If the judge goes on and says, "I can be fair. I can remain an impartial judge in a case like this when a person has pulled a gun on me." That's what he says.
I would have had a hard time with that.
But that's what it is. So he now is continuing to preside.
Did the lawyers bring all of that up?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, there was a formal recusal hearing with the administrative judge. Record was made. It was part of the appellate record. And it was determined by the administrative judge that he could be fair and impartial, and the trial proceeded.
And his lawyers did a bang up. They did a lot of different things, Ray. I mean, there were issues brought up during voir dire where the judge had some procedural matters that were a little bit not in the proper order in terms of the defense being required to make its strikes at a time when they didn't really have to under the statute. And so the appellate court says, well, yeah, that was error for the judge to have committed.
Yeah, but not reversible.
But it was a harmless error. Okay. When you look at what's the harm. So the lawyers were at trial.
But the judge didn't have any trouble letting the jury hear about what happened with the gun.
No, he didn't. But it was in the state's rebuttal to the defense's guilt-innocence presentation.
Okay, and I need to remind people right now it's 6:40 p.m. On this Pi Day. It's 3:14 today. So that's the beginning of Pi. So. And Mr. Bigby is... We have not received word from Huntsville. I see producers in there on the telephone trying to figure that out. He has been in the room being executed. It was an early start tonight. So it's been 41 minutes since he has been in the death chamber, and we have received no word that procedure is over. Just want to remind you about that because those things are very important to Execution Watch. Last week we did a whole hour for Rolando Ruiz, and he was not executed until 10 o'clock, which meant that the witnesses did not cross the road until 10 o'clock.
Well, there were no filings with the United States Supreme Court as...
He's gone. I just got word from the producer that Mr. Bigby has now... The witnesses have come out, so Mr. Bigby has been executed.
According to my understanding, there were no filings in front of the United States Supreme Court, so there was nothing pending.
After 25 years, Mr. Bigby ultimately became a volunteer.
And I believe so, yes, sir.
If I was to the panel of lawyers, to me, I would not have filed a motion to recuse that judge.
Okay? You wouldn't have?
No. If I'm his lawyer, it was going to come in what he did anyway.
Yeah.
Okay? What I would have done... is subpoena the judge to testify how he didn't kill him. Future dangerousness is a big issue.
Yeah.
The fact that he didn't shoot the judge, that should have come forward to the jury. The judge is off the bench because now he's testifying in the case. What are they going to do about that?
Yeah, that testify would have definitely gotten the judge out of the courtroom anyway.
Well, I don't really...
That's a maneuver. Yeah, that's exactly what Mike just showed you, a maneuver. Lawyers can do any kind of maneuver.
I'm not sure kind of an argument would be convincing. Now, if he had approached the bench, found the gun, and handed the gun to the bailiff and say, oh, by the way, I think the judge forgot this, that may be more convincing than pointing the gun at the judge. Call me crazy.
No, Jack. That I understand that. But the situation is now the man's dead.
But he pointed. He didn't just press the trigger.
Well,
this is the judge.
I'm going to have to do the difficult thing because, as you know, in this business, in radio, clock is God. If you're in print media, the printer is God. The editor can tidy you up, but the printer decides when your article ends. And the clock decides that in radio. And Mr. Bigby is unfortunately has been killed. My sympathy to his friends on the row, and thank you guys for listening up. Because that's the only friends he had to me. It's the guys he left sometime earlier today in Livingston, Texas, to go up. We've lost a friend. Jim Skelton. Remarkable guy. I've got to officiate to some degree at his farewell services tomorrow at the criminal courthouse in downtown Houston. If you knew Jim or wanted to know Jim, you can come to 201, is that what it is? 1201 Franklin Street.
20th floor ceremony.
Come in a little early. You got to go through security. Now, Paige says you're going to absolutely run through security. Nobody will say anything. I doubt that. He'll shake me and his peg leg down for sure. And come up to the 20th floor, and the ceremonial courtroom is the biggest thing up there, so you can't miss it. The other thing are probate judges, and they don't need much space to do their shameful work. So come on down if that is your desire, and help us say goodbye for farewell. But goodbye for farewell for Jim for this show is right now. Larry?
Goodbye to Jim.
Jim Skelton, I consider to be a mentor of mine. I would not consider trying a case without at least running some things by Jim, and he would really almost embarrass me by just asking a few questions. And you say, I actually hadn't thought of that. So I'm going to miss that. Jim was also extremely practical about things. So about the best advice Jim gave me on a case I was handling years ago was after I laid out to him all the difficulties that I was having with all the things I was doing for the client and how inappreciative the client was. Jim's response was, just withdraw. Life's too short. don't spend any more time.
Don't show up.
Why would you even let them put you through that? And that was Jim's attitude about so many things. It's like there are certain things in this life that are just not worth doing. Okay, and he would talk about people who I've got to return a book to Jim's family because he gave me the biography of Keith Richards' life.
Okay.
And he says, you know, there's something about somebody who is not overly concerned in their life about what other people think about them. And there's something to be said about that. Now, you know, Jim, that's not exactly the words he used, but that was the sentiment he expressed. So
Larry,
Jim is also the reason I'm.
Was that Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones?
Yeah.
Yes,
that's Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. Okay, that's the Keith Richards. Jim, I'm doing this show now because Jim kind of snookered me into doing it. Mm-hmm. He asked me to come down here and do the billboard, and so I said, okay, fine. I want to do some things in radio. I said, you know, come down, use your voice, do the billboard. And then I get down here and say, well, so long as you're here.
Yeah, right.
you might as well. I've been here ever since. And I don't know what we're going to do without him, but he was a terrific man.
Jack?
Terrific.
You kind of transported him, witnessed him here at the end.
Well, he likes to say that I was his attending physician. I don't know why, but he seemed to not deny me the ability to force medical treatment on him. Jim is an old cowboy, and he didn't like to depend on folks, and he didn't. He wanted to do things, well, his way, and also not to inconvenience folks. And I guess in that respect, I'm kind of pushy. I'm pushy to the point that if he doesn't do things my way and get medical help, then I will keep pestering him until. And I have a lot of endurance, and I'd like to think that Jim kind of went along. But at any rate, he snookered me into this. He just, at first it was just come by.
You want to stick around?
Yeah, I do. If nothing else, well, somebody's got to be a bulwark against
absolutely.
The nonsense that Mike speaks
absolutely.
that's the way it works in the make ready room.
Yeah.
Right?
And, you know, I know it's, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to disappoint you.
Thank you. Mike?
I lived in the streets for a year. I came to Houston living on the streets. I went to law school because I've woken up on the streets with the boot of the police on my back. But I went to law school for my own self, not to be a lawyer. I went to law school so I could defend myself. I never thought a guy like me could be a lawyer. Because they don't like lawyers. But when I was in law school, I had the opportunity to have a dream. And my dream, I heard the name Skelton. And the next day I looked in the phone book, and there was a Jim Skelton. And I called him on the phone, and I said, I'm destined to be your clerk. He said, come on down. I made my little resume. At that time, I had to put on a short hair wig to look presentable. And I went to his office, and I gave him my resume. He looked at it, rolled it in a ball, and threw it in the trash. I got mad, and I got up. I said, that's my resume you threw away. And he looked at me, and he said, I don't need a piece of paper to know what kind of man you are. And he sold me with that. And after that, he gave me the chance to work with him for almost 20 years. And I am a lawyer today because I never thought a lawyer could do it for love and not money. But to see the amount of money that he would pass up, to see people come in and offer him cash money by the suitcase full, and he wouldn't get involved if he didn't like him. But people with no money who he felt were being oppressed, he was right there. And to see a lawyer take a case for no money when he could make money made me realize that you can do this without money. And the last thing I want to say, in all the years I've known Jim, because he did so much for people without money, people would give him gifts, not fees, but appreciation. Jim, thank you. Here.
Oh, he had a dozen beat-up old motorcycles out there and half a dozen cars that didn't hardly run.
But he never kept, he always, because I was close with him, he would always give it to somebody else. He wouldn't take anything. We're not talking fees. We're talking about a token of somebody's friendship. He'd give it away. You know, you can be a lawyer and not be greedy. You can be a human being and not run after money. There is something to this world about caring about people and trying to do the right thing. Because what he does, he was a model for us. And what I see now is money. It's not about money. It's about making a better world for the next generation.
Paige?
And that's what Jim was about.
I started working in Harris County in 1988, and I ran across Jim, inevitably, in the courthouse, like everybody would, and I would sit in the coffee shop with him, and he would answer questions, and I had voluminous questions about how to get started, and how to do my job, and how to be a good lawyer. And Jim was always available to me. I've known him since I first started practicing in Harris County. And he gave me great belief in myself. And every time I screwed up, he would look at me and say, you can do better, and here's where you went wrong. And he was monumental in his ability to help other people and to make them into better lawyers. And I benefited immeasurably from that when I discovered early Wednesday morning that Jim had died. It felt like life was fine Tuesday night when Jim was ill. And Wednesday morning when I woke up, somebody had blown up the state capitol, because he's so monumental in my life that it felt like I lost a physical monument when he died. And I will miss him beyond belief.
Paige, I reserve a little time for myself. And no, Mike, I'm not going to give you a filibuster. It all boils down to definition of terms. There are a couple of definitions for the word class. Jim never saw class in the sense that Karl Marx saw class, or in the sense that liberals see class, or in the sense that even conservatives see class. There's no, as far as Jim's concerned, high class didn't matter. People like Mike had enough class to be his clerk. People like Paige had enough class. Larry's struggle to come out from under the racism that he doesn't talk about, but we all know he experiences on a day-to-day basis. And Jack is, he kind of made fun of Jack for being a conservative and a Republican. And
But he didn't see really any difference between the people around this table. So that form of class, Jim did not practice in. He didn't have any countenance for it. He didn't participate. There's another definition of class. People who do what they do very well. In that definition, Jim had more class than most of the people I have ever met. Mr. Bigby is dead. I think we did reasonable justice with the program, considering our missing baritone. We won't be back for a whole month, and the legal team will figure out how to sort all that out. I want to thank the whole staff. I want to thank Bob for pushing the buttons at the right time. We couldn't have done this without Elizabeth Stein, our producer. I want to thank Otis McClay for making it universally available to all you people all over the world by live streaming, and it'll all be on the archive on executionwatch.org by morning. I want to thank Dave Atwood for calling in and giving us a report from his vigil. I want to thank, of course, Pat. Got a letter about Pat here. Said there's no question that Pat cares. She's on the picket line all the time, and sure enough, she's there on the picket line for us. And without her, we wouldn't know what starts and what finishes in Huntsville. Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee, Paige Janik.
Yannick
with a Y.
Spelled with a J, pronounced Y.
I studied under a guy whose name was Arthur Varner, spelt with a W, pronounced with a V. I got it. And so we have completed. The missing baritone is Jim Skelton. Fare thee well, Jim. Good night.
Jesus' name.